Welcome to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. The partial government shutdown has affected several areas of the economy, but here in the Midwest, agricultural services have suffered to a greater extent and with a broader effect than in other areas of the country. In Iowa and Nebraska, there has been concern on the part of corn and soybean growers that the partial shutdown will affect the distribution of checks meant to help out losses caused by the tariff war with China that's severely reducing the volume of commodities farmers had been used to selling abroad. Farmers who plan to apply for subsidies were worried they would have to wait to get paid until the Agriculture Department's Farm Service Agency offices reopened. However, those worries have been addressed. Yesterday, the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced it would accept farm applications for the tariff relief program after the partial federal government shutdown ends. The announcement is calming worries among many farmers who had no way to provide the required paperwork because the local USD offices are closed. The original deadline was next week. Iowa Farmers Union President Aaron Lehman hadn't submitted his information yet and says the deadline extension is welcome news.
While this is not how we want to be earning our income, and it's a bad policy that's led us into this direction, at the same time, we need to look at every option we have in order to try to make ends meet.
The tariffs have exacerbated several years of low commodity prices for Iowa's corn and soybean farmers, and the tariff war with China have only made that situation worse. Pork producers are also concerned about receiving the subsidy checks that will help them through the tariff war. Al Yunke is the executive director of the Nebraska Pork Producers Association. Yunke says the subsidies are being provided via a market facilitation program that until yesterday was only guaranteed until the middle of January.
Farmers had until January 15th to sign up for the program. So if you haven't signed up yet, if you waited for harvest or you got busy in the fall or whatever the reason, you could still sign up. And again, remember, this is crops, pork, and dairy that are doing the sign-ups. You had till January 15th. Well, now you're unable to do that because our county offices are closed. So we are working with the department to hopefully, when they come back open after the shutdown, that they will extend that date to farmers who have not signed up for the program yet and were unable to get in because of the shutdown. I assume they'll accommodate us, but that's an unknown right now. So that part of it is a mixed bag.
Aren't the people who grow grains like soybean and corn more affected by the situation with the shutdown?
Those offices being closed do affect, I think, the grain side people a lot more, who have loans and who have other business that they do in that office. We're not a program, other than the market facilitation program. Pork producers don't do a lot in those offices.
And also, the Trump administration has deemed the plant employees, the processing plant employees, as essential employees.
So these essential employees, like are at the South Sioux plant, the Triumph Seaboard plant there, are still there inspecting our product, inspecting the meats as they go through, putting the USDA stamp of approval on, so those plants can continue to operate. If those people were not essential employees, we were worried that our processing plants would have had to shut down. So we're grateful that they got the essential employee status. Now, on the other side, there are things we rely on. We have domestic and international market reports and supply reports and all the things that the statistic people at USDA do. We have a big international report due next week. That probably will not, I know it won't be out. And so we're kind of, winging it in our markets and our decision-making on our future markets and our contracts because we can't see the reports on supply and demand and other things that the USDA does a great job of. And that's true on the grain side, too. So again, the shutdown, is it affecting us? Yes, it can affect us in certain ways. Is it to a point where we're losing money as far as payment checks and other things? The answer is no. At this point anyway, knock on wood, we are receiving the second round of those checks, And like I say, there may be a few people that yet need to sign up, and we're hopeful we can take care of them after the shutdown ceases.
Are you concerned about how long this might go on?
The answer there is yes. We need not only the Department of Agriculture, but our farmers and families use a lot of other services and government offices out there, and we need those offices opening and functioning, so we're hopeful there'll be a resolve sooner rather than later. Unfortunately, this isn't a new thing. We've seen shutdowns in the past, and some last a few days, some last a few weeks, some last a few months. We hope for the former and not the latter. We hope it gets over quickly, but we want our USDA workers out there, that it affects our small communities too. Those USDA FSA offices are located out in every county in our states, and those are workers that won't be getting a check shortly, or at least will be applied for unemployment probably, which I know a lot of them have done in the past. But that's not a way to go buy a new car or make a mortgage payment or anything else. So, yeah, we're concerned about the workers and the services. But again, as far as it affecting our farmers directly, other than accessing those services when they need them, we've seen minimal, I'd say, impact at this point in time, at least on the pork side.
Hasn't there been a lot of concern for grain farmers about the delay of the release of crop reports?
It's true with us too. We depend on crop reports too, because a lot of our farmers, obviously we're buying our feed supplies from a feed mill, or a lot of the larger ones own their own feed mills. So we're trying to figure out pricing going into the next 3-4 months and our next batch of pigs, and should we buy now or should we wait, and what's that going to cost us? And then bigger for us, there's an international supply report that I think was due on the 11th that will not be out, and that shows us broadly worldwide what's going on with the supplies, where do we need to be, and where do we need to put our efforts for international marketing, which for our products are over 25% of what we produce leaves the country. And so understanding those markets and those supplies are really important to us too, and to our processors and those that are in that market. So, little things like not having those reports can be kind of a pain in the short term for us. So we're going to have to make do, but we're kind of flying blind right now on some of the things that have become pretty routine with the USDA.
That was Al Yunke, the executive director of the Nebraska Pork Producer Association, talking about how producers are faring during the partial government shutdown, which has closed federal offices that have dispersed subsidy checks to offset losses caused by the U.S. tariff war with China. That partial shutdown is also affecting corn and soybean farmers, as stated by Yunke. Those farmers depend on information provided by crop reports to plan for the future. Todd Holtman is the lead grain market analyst for data provider DTN in Omaha. Holtman says the government's decision to delay monthly and quarterly crop reports is leaving farmers without vital information during a volatile time for agricultural markets.
Every month, USDA puts out what they call a WASDE report, WASDE, and it stands for World Ag Supply and Demand Estimates. And in the January report that would have come out this Friday on the 11th, in that report we would have seen what are normally considered final crop estimates for the U.S. corn and soybean crop of 2018, and we would also see crop estimates for the corn and soybean crops being grown right now in Brazil and Argentina. That's one of the reports that was due to come out this Friday. Another report that USDA also puts out, and this is a quarterly report, it's the December 1 grain stocks report. And that's where they actually go out and inventory the actual corn supplies and soybean supplies and wheat and everything else in the country. And that's actually one of the more accurate, reliable indications of grain demand that we have, and the fact that it only comes out quarterly means that it's going to be missed here on Friday, because that's a very important indicator to us as to how grain demand is going. And then the third report, is a winter wheat seedings report, and that's just an estimate of how much winter wheat was planted this past fall.
Why is it so important to have that information?
Well, it helps to give us a good indication of what things are actually doing in the market. In the case of the grain stocks report in particular, it helps us to assess demand. So right now, we're in a situation where because Argentina had a drought in early 2018, our corn exports have been doing fairly well because we've had less competition from South America this season. So we always have expectations about how it'll go, but the grain stocks report in particular helps us to see how much grain is actually on hand and how that demand is actually doing. So it's a bit of a reality check for us on the grain stocks report. On the supply and demand estimates, I'll grant you that when USDA makes forward-looking estimates, they're not always reliable any more than they are for anyone else that is trying to predict the future. And they might not be as urgently important to us, but they do give us some guideline as to how crop conditions have been in South America and what kind of competition we can expect from them in the upcoming year.
How does this affect farmers, especially considering the situation with China and the whole trade problem that we're having right now?
Yes. Well, that's, to me, the larger concern. In addition to those reports that I talked about that were supposed to come out Friday, we also have daily and weekly reports where USDA lets us know publicly if there any large export sales have been happening. And the fact that we've had a government closed and we've not been able to see the public records on those daily export sales is a bit distressing because it comes at a time when China just started buying more grain from the U.S. again. So it looks to us like China has made some more purchases, but we don't have any confirmation of it yet publicly. And I think the number one concern going ahead, and the biggest reason I hope that the government shutdown does not go on too long, is that right now negotiators from the U.S. and China are speaking as we talk this moment, and they're trying to work out obviously what has been contentious trade terms for the past several months. And they have a deadline of March 1st that they want to get this done by. Well, if China and the U.S. do succeed in coming to a new trade agreement that both sides can live with, it may very well be that China will also go along with that and make several new purchases of U.S. grain. Well, we would hate for that to happen during the time when USDA has blacked out export sale reporting. So that would probably be one of the worst-case scenarios when it comes to trying to assess grain markets for our farm community.
Farmers are already feeling like they're in a bind and concerned about especially the soybean crops of this year and what they're going to do with this really wonderful crop, from what I gather. Like, where will we sell it?
Yes, absolutely. Last year, China bought over 1 billion bushels of U.S. soybeans. This year, we don't know how much they've bought so far, but maybe about 200 million bushels, roughly. So every news of new export sales, especially from China, is very important to understand the market, because without their participation, we're probably looking at a surplus of over 1 billion bushels of soybeans in the United States in the 2018-19 season. And that's a big surplus. There is one feature of this that bothers me a little bit, and I haven't heard anyone talk about it yet, but you know, we're in a partial shutdown, meaning that some government services are still operating. So, for instance, the energy industry still gets energy inventory reports from the Department of Energy for the U.S. government, and Wall Street still gets monthly updates of unemployment and weekly jobless claims. But for some reason, our ag information has not been deemed essential enough for the ag community, and that's something I wish they would reconsider.
Do you think that these issues are clear to the Trump administration and other lawmakers, that all of the effects that this government shutdown is causing, just one thing affects another?
I can't speak for Mr. Trump. I would say I'm sure they're clear to USDA Secretary Perdue. So I hope he's making that known standing up for the ag community on our behalf. But I'm not going to try to outguess Mr. Trump.
Todd Haltman is a lead grain analyst for data provider DTN in Omaha. Haltman is concerned about the effects of the partial government shutdown on agriculture and agricultural markets, as crop reports and other vital information is not being published in a timely manner. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Next week, Iowa lawmakers will return to the State House to begin the 2019 legislative session. Before the holidays, I spoke with Democratic State Representative from Sioux City, Chris Hall, about some of the Democrats' priorities for the session. Hall said he was concerned about fixing some of the problems associated with privatized Medicaid, the possible effects of tax cuts on the state budget, and the need to properly fund K-12 schools and the judiciary in Iowa. I talked this week with Republican State Representative John Wills of Dickinson County about those same issues and more. Wills says Republicans are likely to take another look at tax rates and tax cuts in Iowa.
Yeah, I think we'll definitely take a look at the tax credits and issues associated with that. I don't know if we'll get things accomplished this year or if we might more just look at it this year and then accomplish it next year. But I think we need to also look at property taxes and some other tax issues that are just not very fair in the state of Iowa and make us a little bit less competitive on the regional scale and maybe even the nation.
Do you think with the tax cuts that have already been, instituted, I don't know if they've all taken place, I don't think so yet, some Democrats were saying they were concerned about the effect of the tax cuts and funding state programs. Are you concerned about that?
No, actually, our revenues have increased 7.1% just in the last 6 months, and that is with tax reform and, starting to enact some of these tax reforms that we've done. So I think we can only see that increasing even more over the next few years. And most of that is due to the federal tax reform,
right?
Kind of sends more money into the state. Well, we really look at that and say, well, that money should stay in the pocketbooks of Iowa citizens and not come into the state as a boon to our economy or state coffers. What we'd do with it is just spend it anyway. And so it's just a little bit better in our mind to send it back to the place where it was supposed to go in the first place.
Voters in Iowa have said one of their biggest priorities is funding education, and mostly we talk about K-12 education, but it also includes higher ed, the Regent schools. What do you think the likelihood is that you'll be able to continue the 1 cent statewide sales tax for infrastructure projects? There seems to be a big call to extend that out past 2029.
Yeah, we passed that in the House last year. I think I was one of three votes that said no. I voted against it last year simply because there were too many restrictions placed on the supervisors, the boards of supervisors, and I really didn't think that was something we wanted to do. You know, if we're going to provide a pool of money, then we should just allow them to use that money where they see fit, rather than say, well, you can use it, but you got to do it this way. So I kind of drew a line and said, no, I'm going to vote no on that. So I don't know where that will go. The Senate didn't pick it up. They didn't move it at all. So that kind of makes me wonder if it's not as big of an issue in the Senate.
You know, the other thing I wanted to ask you about is Medicaid privatization and dealing with some of those issues. I've talked to a lot of Democrats and Republicans, you know, since the election and before the midterm elections, about how they would like to see some changes made to how the program is run to help deal with some of the problems. What would you like to see happen?
Well, I really believe that there are some changes yet to be made. However, the growth of Medicaid was slowed because of the privatization, and that's what we really needed to see. You see, our budget no longer is controlled by education. It used to be controlled by K-12 education funding. Now that has been overtaken by Medicaid, and so we needed to do something to slow that growth. So there are some changes that need to be made. There was a second oversight committee meeting. There was a first and a second oversight committee meeting just completed in December. The report has not been sent out to us yet. So I'd really like to see what that oversight report says before I'd commit to, you know, any changes, because that oversight committee was a bipartisan group of folks and legislators, and you know, hopefully they have some good suggestions for us.
I know the governor and others have said they also would like to forge ahead with putting hopefully some more money towards mental health system improvements, and especially also for children, because there hasn't been a lot of services available, especially for children in Iowa. But I guess the question is, where would the money come from?
As I said, you know, our revenues are growing 7.1% in the last 7 months, 6 months. So we definitely have some increased revenues to deal with. I believe that mental health funding is vitally important, that we should really look at that as an issue. And I think funding is going to be there. We just have to make it a priority at the beginning of session, or towards the beginning, versus at the end, where it has typically been done. And then we just say, well, we only have this amount left, so that's what we're going to do. I think we need to really kind of reverse it a little bit and say it's going to come out right away, and we know exactly how much it's going to be, and this is how much is needed, and we're going to do that.
There's also been a lot of concern about the financial health of the state's judiciary system, and fears that some of the state's county courthouses might actually have to shut down. Do you think that we need to put more money towards the judiciary and towards the prisons as well?
Yeah, when we talk about closing courthouses, we're talking about closing just the judicial portion of the courthouse. We're not talking about those county functions. That's always bandied about as a threat by the judicial system and judicial branch. And that was really a sad thing when that was brought out last year, where what 30 courthouses would have to shut down. Well, everybody just automatically thinks their county courthouse is going to be shuttered and closed, and that's not exactly true. I think that we do need to increase funding to certain portions of our judicial system, especially in the public safety arena, where we've got almost half of our highway patrols, for example, that are going to retire in the next 10 years, or they're eligible to retire in the next 10 years. And we don't have the money to train, 110 new highway patrols in the next 10 years. And so we really need to look at that. We've got to have a foresight to look at our highway patrol and different other things with some extra funding to help with those kind of issues as well. But I think the judicial system is doing fine, and we'll figure something out with that.
Last year, the fetal heartbeat bill passed. That seems to be tied up in a lawsuit right now. Do you think that there'll be more legislation on abortion this year? And also, do you think that lawmakers will take up the idea from Governor Reynolds about providing over-the-counter contraception instead of having to have a prescription?
Boy, I don't know the issue on that second part. I read that a few days ago. I don't know anything about it, to be honest, and so I'd hate to comment. I don't know the cost, or it'll cost something. I just don't know who pays for it or where it comes from. So I'd hate to comment on it and not be right. But as far as additional abortion type things, you know, I think that, you know, now with the fetal heartbeat bill completed and going through the judicial system, we really need to start looking at, you know, taking care of babies when they're born and making sure that they have adequate ability to survive and grow and flourish. And I think we need to really look at, you know, birth control is an issue. You know, we need to look at all those kind of things, and specifically in health related things. I don't look at abortion as being a healthcare thing at all, but we need to look at the healthcare side of things and improve that as well.
Last year, the House and Senate passed the Right to Bear Arms resolution. Do you think that you will be pushing to get that approved this year, at least this year or next year, for it to go to the people of Iowa for a vote?
Yeah, I think this is going to be a priority issue for both chambers, and I'd look for it to happen fairly quickly. I think it's really something that we need to do and move forward. You know, Iowa being one of about six or seven other states that don't have a constitutional amendment in their constitution, in their state constitution, for the Second Amendment. And, you know, while the federal government does have that constitutional amendment, that doesn't always guarantee you at the state level that would continue to happen and continue to be an important issue. And so I think it's something that we need to just to show folks that, hey, here in Iowa, you do have a constitutional amendment to keep and bear arms.
Last year, the House and Senate passed a water quality bill that some Democrats said was not enough and did not have enough funding, and that it favored farmers over the environment. What do you think will happen this year in terms of water quality?
Well, I think that we will continue the conversation, and there may be some things that we do this year on water quality, especially I just had a subcommittee meeting down in Des Moines with a bipartisan group of people on small communities and water quality. And some of our small communities are, you know, they're putting $2 and $3 million into a sanitary sewer system. And are we really getting a benefit out of that? Some of those communities are actually disbanding and no longer being communities, so they don't have to provide that service. So then we've got a bunch of septic tanks that are being put in, and how is that helping our water quality? So we really need to look at some of those issues as well and try to figure out how we can help our small communities to protect water quality, protect maybe that sanitary sewer kind of stuff, but at the same time kind of figure out, well, are we really getting the big bang for our buck that we're spending, or is it just eye candy that we're just making these communities do some things that really is not improving water quality, but it's making them cross the T's and dot the I's, so to speak. You know, we really need to look at practicality of what we're doing.
I know last year, after the water quality measure was signed, there was a lot of concern on the part of some Democrats that farmers got what they wanted out of it, but they felt not enough was done to protect water systems in the state.
You know, it's important to remember that when the water quality bill is fully implemented in 2 years, there will be $15 million available for agricultural conservation practices and conservation work, and then $12 million available for cities and small towns. So there's a significant amount of money going towards the cities and the small towns as well. You know, just sometimes those projects are a little bit more expensive than what the rural practices are. So the question is that money going to go, you know, go far or not? And I would kind of, you know, say that, you know, it probably will pay us benefits to put more money into the rural sector, simply because it's less expensive. And so you do get a bigger bang for your buck for every dollar that we put into the a conservation practice in the rural area, we're probably going to get a good good savings of nutrients leaving the state for every dollar that we put into the rural or the urban side, we're not going to get as good of a value. So it's important to put our dollars where they're going to get the most benefit.
That was Republican State Representative John Wills of Dickinson County talking about taxes, gun rights, education spending, and other issues likely to be up for debate in the 2019 Iowa legislative session, which begins next Monday. You're listening to The Exchange here on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Recently, the annual America's Health Rankings report came out and showed some of the areas that Iowa is doing well in and some areas where there's room for improvement. The 2018 report says Iowa is doing a better job educating and caring for children, which includes a number one ranking for the percentage of students that graduate from high school. But our citizens are increasingly obese and affected by heart disease and cancer. Dr. Rhonda Randall is one of the authors of the report put out by United Healthcare National Markets. Randall says the 2018 report uses data from a large number of sources and focuses on many different areas of concern.
This year's report includes 35 different measures of our health. Each of those measures comes from about a dozen different public agencies, and a scientific advisory committee gives each measure a specific amount of weight that goes into compiling the state's ranking, and it gives us a holistic view of our nation's health. Those 35 measures fall into four different categories: our behaviors, the things that we're choosing as individuals, the community and environment where you live — we know where you live matters — public policy is the third, and clinical care you receive when you go to a doctor or a dentist or a hospital. And then ultimately, outcomes, things like premature death, for example, that fall into health outcomes. So we're looking at health very holistically, very comprehensively.
One of the things I saw concerning Iowa had to do with obesity and how obesity is increasing here in the state. And that has become a big concern for healthcare providers and insurers here.
Right. So in the past year, obesity increased 14% in Iowa. Now 36.4% of adults are self-reporting that they are obese. That's done — a survey of CDC does asks individuals their height and weight, and from that a BMI is calculated. And so we're seeing a significant increase in that across the nation, but it's concerning for Iowa because it's the number one area that you have an opportunity to improve.
And that also leads into issues like cardiovascular disease, diabetes. There are so many things that can go wrong when you get to be, you know, get to be obese.
Right, and it impacts your quality of life. So, you know, think about spending more time on medications, more time with doctors. It also impacts the state's resources from needing more providers, more physicians, more healthcare professionals to take care of obesity-related diseases. And we can't medicalize ourselves out of this problem. We've got to start with changing our lifestyle.
Do you think obesity has fed into the increasing cancer rate in Iowa?
There's definitely a link between obesity and cancer. We know there's a very strong linkage between smoking and cancer, but also a link between obesity and cancer. When you have excessive weight, you're in a constant state of inflammation in your body, and we know that there is a higher risk of developing cancer associated with obesity.
And also another area I noticed on here was the suicide rate. That the suicide rate has increased in Iowa. Do we know why, or is there any way we can figure out how to deal with that issue?
So this report doesn't tell us for any of the measures that are included why, but it's really important that states ask that question. So we recommend that there be a strong partnership with the public health community, with the state health department, to understand the reasons why. Within our report and online, our americashealthrankings.org, there are subpopulation data. So you can take a measure like suicide and have a greater understanding of the populations that are most affected by that increase in suicide rate. And we do know that we're seeing premature death rate increase in the state of Iowa, and one of the reasons for that is suicide.
I wonder if the fact that we have more mental health care providers in the state than we did, of course, we need many more here. However, we are, that is increasing in Iowa, and I'm hoping that that will help with some of the many mental health issues, including addiction and issues like that in the state that people have not been able to really find anyone to help them with at times.
Yeah, you know, there's several measures that take a look at some of the things that you just mentioned. First of all, Iowa ranks number 7 for frequent mental distress. This is a percentage of adults who are responding to that similar survey from the CDC saying, on a frequent basis, I feel mental distress. The drug death rate in Iowa is one of the lowest in the nation. You're ranked 4th in the nation for that. We're at 9.8 deaths for every 100,000 people in the population. The number one state in the nation has 6.8. So where we're seeing this troublesome trend nationally, Iowa has one of the lowest rates of drug deaths. And at the same time, you're challenged in regard to the number of mental health providers that are licensed to practice in the state, ranked 43rd in the nation there. So it's important to take a look at all of those measures when you're having the conversation around mental health.
I know the state is especially trying to provide more mental health care for children because there didn't seem to be many mental health providers for them. But I did see in the report that Iowa is actually doing a little better when it comes to children, especially when it comes to children living in poverty.
Yeah, that's a great socioeconomic indicator. In fact, we saw the childhood poverty percentage decrease nationally. It's a key indicator of socioeconomic status and therefore overall health. It's decreased 19% in the past 5 years, but the most dramatic increase has been in the last year, a 6% drop in children living in poverty. We know there's a strong correlation between the employment rate for their parents and children living in poverty, so it's a good indicator that we're setting children up for better health throughout the rest of their life because less of them are living in poverty now than in the past.
Well, Iowa was also listed as the 5th best state when it comes to the percentage of residents who are uninsured. I have to think that's a good sign.
Right. We know that the insurability for somebody, whether or not they have health insurance, is one of the 35 measures that looks at the overall health of this report. The individuals who have insurance are more likely to get their preventative care, for example, and Iowa is ranked 5th in the nation this year for that measure.
That was Dr. Rhonda Randall, a spokesperson for United Healthcare National Markets, which recently published the 2018 America's Health Ranking Report. The report shows Iowans need to reduce high rates of obesity that can lead to cardiac problems, diabetes, and other diseases. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Next week, the Sioux City Human Rights Commission is holding an event at the Sioux City Public Museum to recognize the importance of the Me Too movement to prevent sexual harassment and abuse. Karen Mackey is the director of the Sioux City Human Rights Commission. She says this Me 3 event takes a look at the movement and beyond it to call attention to some of the services in Siouxland that can help those who have been affected by sexual harassment and assault, and also to raise awareness about the issue in general.
You know, when you are sexually assaulted, it's very important to do a rape kit and to follow a certain protocol. And there are a small number of medical professionals in our community who are trained to do that. And right now they are all located at St. Luke's. So it's important to know that.
Right.
For example, to know that that's the hospital you need to go to because they have the providers that then can follow the chain of control and handle things properly so that ultimately if the county attorney makes a decision to prosecute, they have appropriate evidence to use, either to take someone to court or to exonerate them.
How much do you think the Me Too movement has helped in this regard to at least make people aware of what's going on. And probably the next step would be trying to change how we think about the way we treat each other, especially in the workplace, how between men and women, and sometimes between people of the same gender. Do you think it has helped make especially workplaces more cognizant of this problem?
I hope so. I can tell you that in my work, we regularly run into instances where it's almost always women who have been sometimes horrifically sexually harassed by supervisors, coworkers. It might be a vendor who isn't even employed there, but comes on the site. Those kinds of things happen regularly, sadly, even in our community.
What about people that are maybe transgender? Do they suffer from this at a different rate or for different reasons because people don't accept them?
I believe that transgender people are disproportionately harassed because of who they are. Just look at the issue over what bathroom people use. I don't know about you, but when I go to use the bathroom, that's what I'm doing. And in women's bathrooms, there are stalls. So there really isn't an issue. Actually, transgender people, the trans people that I know, they rarely try to even use a restroom in public because they know there may be problems. Unless they can pass very well, they just don't even take the chance. Or they will take someone with them to stand guard and make sure they're okay, because they're more fearful of being assaulted or harassed, actually, than the other way around.
That was Karen Mackey, the director of the Sioux City Human Rights Commission, talking about next week's Me3 event at the Sioux City Public Museum. Participants will talk about the prevalence of sexual harassment and assault in the workplace and everyday life. The event takes place Wednesday, January 16th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the museum. You should register through the Sioux City Public Museum by next Monday, January 14th. And finally today, as we enjoy the unusually balmy January weather in Iowa, we look back at a devastating blizzard that swept across the plains more than a century ago this week. Here's Jim Skop with another small wonder.
Blizzard of 1888. A January thaw is what all of us look forward to right now, a breath of warmth that reopens our hope that someday soon April will return. Two cold a winter days, maybe three, of 40 degrees and no wind. Heaven comes to Siouxland. And that's the relief people felt early on January 12, 1888, when most of those who'd put down homesteads had just arrived. Here's how David Laskin describes that morning. Everyone who wrote about January 12 noticed something different about the quality of that morning. Strange color and texture of the sky, the preternatural balminess, the haze, the fog, the softness of the south wind, the thrilling smell of thaw, the great waves of snow on the prairie that gleamed in the winter sun. And then this. The one aspect they all agreed on was the sudden welcome rise of temperature. A January thaw, a morning to remember, but a balmy prelude to horror. Laskin's book, The Children's Blizzard, tells the story. When that strange warmth suddenly lifted, hundreds of people, most of them children, perished in a blizzard that made prairie skies dark as night and created massive drifts in winds that drove crystallized snow into your face so ferociously it filled up what flesh it didn't tear away. 7 miles east of Freeman, South Dakota, 5 boys died, lost in the unremitting blast of snow. 3 of them were Kaufmans, Johann, Heinrich, Elias. What they and 2 other boys intended was simply to get to safety at the Graber House, a quarter mile east of the school, Ratsliff, number 66. The wall they hit was zero visibility blizzard. The victims' families were all Schweitzers, German-speaking Mennonites booted from Russia, who'd come to the Dakota Territory with 50 other families seeking the religious freedom they'd looked to find for 200 years and the opportunity to live a good and safe life. None of them had it easy. Sometimes their children would alternate attending school because families didn't have shoes enough to go around. But there was promise here in Dakota. And then came the children's blizzard. Those five Freeman boys just disappeared. And even though search parties went out the next morning in the swirling remnants, no one found them until 3 days later on the Sabbath, when a man spotted an arm jutting from a snowbank, an arm belonging to the eldest Kaufman, Johann, who was likely holding up a coat to shield the younger boys from the killer. They ended up 2.5 miles southeast of Ratcliffe 66, buried by the blizzard just 40 feet from the farmhouse of the man who found them. Story goes that man went to church with the news that Sunday. I don't know if he interrupted worship. I don't know what they might have been singing, but I can guess how hard they prayed. No one knows precisely how many people perished in that massive blizzard. Most estimate the grim death toll at somewhere near to 250. It all began with a sweet January thaw that, quick as a fox, descended into madness. At Valentine, Nebraska, the temperature was 30 degrees at 6 in the morning, 6 degrees at 2 in the afternoon, 14 below at 9 that night. Somewhere out in south central Nebraska, you'll find a highway marker that tells that neighborhood's chapter of the story. But there's nothing at all east of Freeman, where five boys died. There's no sign, no story, only endless rows of corn and soybeans. Even the farms are gone. All the way from Russia, those Schweitzers carried with them an old Mennonite hymn, something with a first line that went like this. Verlos und verlassen, sehnt sich oft mein Herz nach stiller Ruhe. When I'm lonely and defenseless, my heart longs for rest and peace. Maybe that Sunday, that old favorite was the one they all went back to, all of them. If not that Sunday, surely the next. Christ with me.
And that's it for this edition of The Exchange. Be sure to join us next Tuesday morning at 10 when we have live coverage of Governor Reynolds' condition of the state speech, with also some reaction from local Republicans and Democrats. And then join us next Wednesday at noon for another edition of The Exchange. Thanks for listening. I'm Mary Hartnett.